This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. We're taking a moment to celebrate women and all that they carry at work, in relationships, in families, and in the many roles they hold every day. Women have played a strong role in my life. I was raised by a single mother. She worked multiple jobs at once, and I can't imagine how difficult I was to deal with as a child. But somehow, my mom and a village made it work. I'm sure some of our listeners can also think of someone like that in their own lives. Often the strongest people in our lives are usually the ones holding everything together, which also means they are the last ones to get support themselves, or who might need someone to talk to the most. And that's where BetterHelp comes in. BetterHelp has quality therapists who work according to a strict code of conduct and are fully licensed in the U.S. BetterHelp does the initial matching work for you so you can focus on your therapy goals. A short questionnaire helps identify your needs and preferences, and their 12 plus years of experience and industry-leading match fulfillment rate means they typically get it right the first time. And if you're not happy with your match, you can switch to a different therapist at any time from their tailored recommendations. They also have great client reviews. With over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy program, having served over 6 million people globally, and it works, with an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on over 1.7 million client reviews. Your emotional well-being matters. Find support and feel lighter in therapy. Sign up and get 10% off at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com. Have you ever started a new project and then introduced it to the world? It's not just hard, it's terrifying. So much work goes into this thing that you're not entirely sure will work out, and it can be hard to make that leap of faith. Trust me, I know. When Troy and I launched this podcast, we had no idea what we were doing. What if no one listens? What if I make a fool of myself? What if no one buys our products? And believe me, all that bad stuff happened. But I'm happy that we took that leap of faith. We had a lot of tools to help us along the way, and one of the best decisions we made was to have a partner like Shopify on our side to help. Shopify is the commerce platform behind millions of businesses around the world and 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S., from household names like American Hauntings to brands just getting started. Get the word out like you have a marketing team behind you. Easily create email and social media campaigns wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling. And what if you get stuck? Well, Shopify is always around to share advice with their award-winning 24/7 customer support. And you can trust me, my job is to literally try and anticipate how people online might be confused or break technology or interact with products. And I really, truly love Shopify's products. It's time to turn those what-ifs into with Shopify today. Sign up for your $1 per month trial today at shopify.com/hauntings. Go to shopify.com/hauntings. That's shopify.com/hauntings. Shopify, making commerce better for everyone.
Springfield, Illinois has always been the kind of place where life runs on routine. Morning traffic moves the same way it always has. Neighborhoods settle in at night. People believe there are certain hours when nothing bad is supposed to happen. Daytime feels safe. Nighttime feels private. And somewhere between the two, we convince ourselves we understand the rules. But in the early 1980s, Springfield learned something it never forgot. That violence doesn't follow schedules. It doesn't need chaos. And that some of the most disturbing crimes don't arrive screaming for attention. They arrive quietly, calmly, and in control. On one morning, a man walked into a neighborhood hardware store while the city was wide awake. On another night, a door opened without force while the city slept. Different hours, different places, different people, but the same result. Lives ended violently, families shattered, and questions that never found answers. This is American Dread, true stories of tragedy and terror from the dark side of the American heartland. American Dread is part of the American Hauntings Podcast Network. I'm your host, Adam White. On this episode, we're going back to Springfield, Illinois, to a time when two crimes, just a year and a half apart, forced an entire city to confront an unsettling truth that safety is thinner than we think, that trust can be used as a weapon, and that control, not chaos, is often what makes violence most terrifying. One crime unfolded under harsh store lighting, in full daylight, on a busy street. The other crept in quietly, after midnight, behind locked doors. They're not connected by suspects. They're not connected by motive. But they are bound by something deeper. Control. Because in both cases, the people who died weren't caught off guard by panic or noise. They were overpowered by certainty. And once that certainty took a hold, everything else followed. Springfield in 1981 was a city caught between heirs. Factories were closing, manufacturing jobs were disappearing, inflation was climbing, violent crime across Illinois was rising. Between the 1970s and the early 1980s, violent crime in Illinois increased by more than 20%. Robberies climbed sharply. Assaults became more aggressive. Police departments in mid-sized cities like Springfield were stretched thin. But Springfield still felt insulated. This wasn't Chicago. This wasn't East St. Louis. This was a city where neighbors knew each other, where family businesses stayed open for generations, where doors were still unlocked during the day, until March 18th, 1981. Lauterbach Cottage Hardware Store sat on the corner of South Grand Avenue and 15th Street. Built in 1920, it was old even then, a three-story wooden frame building that felt frozen in time. The floors creaked when you walked across them. Shelves bowed under the decades of stock. Some items were still sealed in packages from the 1930s and 40s. The air smelled like oil, metal, and dust. That morning, 48-year-old Yvonne Lauterbach was behind the counter. The store had been part of her life for years. She knew the customers. She knew the rhythm. Next door, sharing the same structure, 37-year-old Floyd Gettings worked in the sewing machine repair shop. A husband, a father, a man who fixed things for a living. Just after 9 a.m., a man walked in. Witnesses later described him as a light-skinned black male, mid-40s, with long, graying afro-style hair, a beard, a mustache. He was wearing a blue coat over a brown jacket. He didn't browse. He didn't speak. He didn't hesitate. He walked straight to the back of the store and took an axe off the wall. What happened next still unsettles investigators decades later. He forced Yvonne to the front of the store. At nearly the same moment, John Ewing walked in to buy contact paper. A routine errand on a normal morning for this 64-year-old retiree. Floyd stepped forward from the repair area, sensing something was wrong. The man ordered all three to kneel. There was no shouting, no panic, no chaos, just control. Then, he swung. John Ewing was struck multiple times with the sharp end of the axe and died before the police arrived. Yvonne and Floyd were also struck. suffering severe puncture wounds to the head that would follow them for the rest of their lives. The attacker took roughly $40 from the cash register and an unknown amount from wallets. Then he walked out. He headed east on South Grand Avenue and vanished into the daylight. 30 minutes later, a customer arrived to pick up a sewing machine. He heard a rasp breathing sound behind the counter, and then the police arrived to the scene, a scene that would never leave them. The response was immediate and massive by Springfield standards. 10 detectives, 10 patrol officers, door-to-door searches, garages checked, sheds searched, alleys canvassed, tips poured in. But the case is already starting to slip. Daylight crimes are among the hardest to solve. In 1981, there were no security cameras, no DNA testing, fingerprint databases were slow and limited. Police released a composite sketch. Hundreds of people believed they recognized the face. Each lead was chased, but each subject was cleared. Investigators even turned to hypnosis, a common tool at the time, hoping to unlock buried memories. Nothing worked, though. Fear changed daily life. Parents kept their children inside. Stores closed early. Doors that had never been locked suddenly were. Then came the lead that nearly cracked the case. And instead, it changed Illinois state law. A psychiatric patient at St. John's Hospital told police another patient had confessed to killing John Ewing. Nurse Ellen McCall confirmed the man's resemblance to the composite sketch. Police believed they were close. But Nurse McCall, she refused to release the name, citing the Illinois Mental Health and Developmental Confidential Act. Police subpoenaed her. She refused. A judge fined her. She appealed. For more than a year, the investigation stalled. Not because the police stopped working, but because the law stopped them cold. By the time the police obtained the subject's name during an unrelated investigation in 1982, he was interviewed and cleared. Illinois later amended the law, allowing judges to order disclosure in murder investigation. The system learned. The victims did not benefit, though. John Ewing died that morning. Yvonne Lauterbach lived with lasting trauma, later earning a degree from Lincoln Land Community College before dying in 2000. Police called it murder delayed. Floyd Gettings spent weeks in a coma, lost memory, relearned how to speak and move, and died in 1989. Another murder delayed. The store never reopened. His set abandoned for decades. Items inside remained exactly where they were left. In 2018, the building was demolished. The ground is empty. The answers are not. The axe murder didn't end when the store went quiet. It didn't end when the doors stayed locked. It didn't end when the case cooled. What it did was change Springfield. After March 1981, people started paying attention to things they'd never thought about before. Who was walking down the street? Who had a reason to be somewhere? Who looked out of place? The city learned something uncomfortable, that violence doesn't need darkness, and it doesn't need permission. But as terrifying as that was, Springfield still held on to one false comfort, that what happened at Lauterbach was an exception. A stranger, a fluke, a nightmare that came and went. And then the city learned something worse, because when violence returned, it didn't come through the front door. In daylight, it came quietly, it came at night, and it came from inside. In the early morning hours of November 21st, 1982, while most of Springfield slept, a home on South Park Street was entered without force. There was no glass breaking, no door kicked in, no sound loud enough to wake the neighbors, just a key turning in a lock. Inside the house were 48-year-old David Davidson and 46-year-old Mary Davidson. They were a husband and wife. They were home. They believed the door was closed to the world outside. What happened next would later be described in court as one of the most brutal crimes in Sangamon County had seen since the Lauterbach massacre. David and Mary Davidson were attacked over and over. They were stabbed repeatedly. They were beaten with a crowbar. And the most disturbing question wasn't how it happened. It was who could do this and why. Unlike the Lauterbach case, where the killer vanished into the daylight and left nothing but silence behind, this crime produced something almost immediately. The key. The key that opened the front door. The key that proved the killers didn't break in. The key that pointed inward, not outward. Police quickly identified two suspects. The first was Stephen Mark Pryor, who investigators said was responsible for stabbing the victims more than 20 times. The second was Ralph Lee Davidson, the couple's adopted son, just 17 years old. Court records later made it clear what happened inside that house. Ralph Davidson held his father while Pryor stabbed him. Then Pryor walked into the bedroom and stabbed Mary Davidson. A crowbar was used. The violence didn't stop when it could have. It continued because it was meant to. This wasn't panic. This wasn't an argument that spun out of control. This was downright murder. Later, both men would admit what investigators had already believed. The idea to kill David and Mary Davidson came from their own son. The motive was painfully small. Money, a car, credit cards, a place to live without rules. The plan collapsed almost immediately, but the damage was permanent. In court, prosecutors treated the case for what it was, a multiple homicide carried out with extreme violence. Former Sangamon County State's Attorney Bill Roberts later said it was one of the most senseless and brutal crimes he'd ever prosecuted. He sought the death penalty for Pryor, but the request was denied. The judge cited Pryor's age, just 20 years old, as a reason not to impose death. Both Pryor and Davidson were sentenced to 40 years in prison. At the time, Illinois law allowed day for day good time. For every day served, another day could be credited. In real terms, that meant 40 years didn't mean 40 years. It meant far less. And it meant the door was not closed forever. Pryor was eventually paroled in 2002. He was discharged from parole in 2005. And for a time, it appeared the story might end there, filed away as an old horror from another era. It didn't, because the past has a way of walking back in. On August 18th, 2010, 28 years after the Davidson murders, another woman was killed. Her name was Diane Hoagland. She was 54 years old. She was shot outside her rural Alexander home after returning from a morning walk. Investigators later said the final shot was fired from point-blank range. They described it as an execution style. What stood out immediately was how rare the crime was. There was no relationship between the victim and the suspect, no domestic history, no personal connections. Police believe she had simply interrupted a robbery. And then came the arrest. Illinois State Police arrested Stephen Mark Pryor. This time, there was DNA. This time, there was physical evidence. This time, there was no mystery about who did it. Pryor was charged with multiple counts of first-degree murder. Bond was set at $2 million. In 2011, a jury convicted him. Because of the prior murder convictions, the death of David and Mary Davidson, Pryor was sentenced to a natural life in prison. And that's where the story tightens into something hard to escape. Because Pryor did not commit one murder, he committed three, two in 1982, one in 2010. And the space between them is not empty. A former state's attorney said it plainly. If Pryor had been executed for the Davidson murders, Diane would still be alive. That's not an opinion. That's the brutal truth. The criminal justice system had failed. And it's the part no one ever forgets, especially the families. Ralph Lee Davidson didn't disappear either. After serving his sentence for murder of his parents, he was released. In 2007, he was involved in another fatal beating, this time outside an apartment building in Springfield. He pled guilty to involuntary manslaughter and received a 10-year sentence. At sentencing, a judge rejected the arraignment that his violence was unlikely to happen again. He has killed 3 people in his lifetime, the judge said. That sentence hangs in the air for a reason, because it tells you this wasn't a single bad night. It was a pattern. Stephen Mark Pryor is no longer a question mark. He is no longer a suspect. He is no longer a possibility. He is a convicted murderer multiple times over. Today, Pryor is housed at the Danville Correctional Center, where he will remain for the rest of his natural life. That sentence exists because the system finally caught up to what he had already proven. That when given the chance, he kills. Not once, not by accident, but on purpose, again and again. Ralph Davison does not get that ending. He was the one who planned the first murders, the one who decided his parents were expendable, the one who opened the door and invited death inside. He served his time, he was released. And after his release, he beat another man to death. The violence did not stop with his parents. Ralph Davidson died at the age of 55 at 2:17 p.m. on Friday, April 9th, 2021, at Barnes Jewish Hospital in St. Louis. Lauterbach Cottage is still remembered because the killer is never found. The Davidson case is remembered because the killers were found. And because even that didn't stop the story from continuing. One crime vanished into daylight, leaving a city staring at unanswered questions. The other left a paper trail that kept growing. Court records, sentencing hearings, appeals, and other murders decades later. Different paths, same ending. Control. One killer took control in the middle of the day. Another took advantage of trust in the middle of the night. One vanished without a name. One left a record that still doesn't explain why. Both left Springfield with the same question. How close does violence have to be before we see it coming? This has been American Dread. True stories of tragedy and terror from the dark side of American heartland. American Dread is part of the American Hauntings Podcast Network. If this episode stayed with you, if it felt heavy, if it followed you longer than you expected, that's because it was never meant to be let go. Both these cases were built on the same thing. Control. Control over the moment. Control over the room. Control over the people who never saw it coming. And long after the crime scenes were cleared, after the courtrooms emptied, after the buildings came down, that control still lingers. Because somewhere between daylight and darkness, between trust and fear, between a locked door and a quiet street, someone always pays the price. I'm Adam White, and sometimes the most frightening stories aren't the ones with endings. They're the ones that remind us how close violence really is, and how easily control can change everything.
This episode was brought to you by the American Hauntings Podcast Network.